This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
This is Dana Cowan, host of Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for a couple of years now, and even after all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices on our network. Each week, I record my show with a window out onto people eating pizza. Why is that important? Because this is food radio. I am excited to bring the listeners incredible stories from women in hospitality, people who care enormously about food, where it comes from, and the stories behind it. All of us here at HRN make food radio because we love it. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Here's how you do it. You go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and do that right now. You can even show some love for my show by selecting Speaking Broadly in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN. Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Today, I am in Charleston, South Carolina, with an extraordinary woman who is both a musician and an incredible chef. Chidi Kumar, welcome to Speaking Broadly.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today, I want to talk about your childhood, the birth of your love of food, and a little bit about the Bronx.
Okay.
So can you tell me about your family and how they started in Pittsburgh, and then you were there for just a few months and then went back to India, but did arrive back in the U.S.?
Yeah. So like you said, my parents were in America. They were part of the partition era of India, and my mom lost her parents in that migration. Very violently.
What does that mean? That's terrible.
Yeah, so my mom and her family grew up in what is now Pakistan, and they were Hindu, and you know, when the border was arbitrarily drawn, and there's all these stories about how that border was drawn by the British as a part of, you know, what I guess India had to suffer some, we had to pay a price to get our own country back. But the border was drawn, and all the Muslims, like the Muslims were supposed to live in Pakistan, and that also meant that the Hindus were maybe not welcome there anymore. So my mom came from a very affluent family that was like deep into, like, my great-grandfather had mines, and like he was a, you know, sultan basically, but they kind of lost everything, and they you know, even their neighbor who had been sort of my grandmother's like adopted brother, you know, turns out they kind of set fire to my mom's house. And so they had to go live in this camp for a few months. And then they got on a train, and it was stopped, and everybody was killed except for a few kids. And my mom was one of those children. Horrific.
Horrific.
Horrific. So there's many stories about my parents and how they met, and just many, you know, as much as fate dealt her the cruelest of hands, she, the life also took care of her after this, you know, immeasurable tragedy. She met my dad, and they very
much. Where did they meet?
They met in school. So my mom actually got a scholarship for children who were orphaned in this, and went to school in Rajasthan, which is not anywhere near where she was from. And my dad happened to be like growing up in a small army cantonment town where the British army was stationed. So he witnessed a lot of violence on from that side, just on the streets, and he was just this like young nerd, and he, you know, came from both of my parents came from families of nine, and he was like just driven by education. He just wanted to read all the time, and his family was not very supportive of that. They just wanted him to go be a banker, just like, you know, or be a business guy. But he was kind of like had this weird Anglophilia. As much as he hated the British and wanted them out of our country, he was also like reading Thomas Hardy and memorizing Winston Churchill's speeches. And so they met in graduate school, and you know, they couldn't date. I mean, and they were not of the same caste. And at that time, it was like all a big no-no. But my mom didn't have parents, so who's going to find her a husband? And my dad's family was kind of disinterested because he was like this weirdo who wanted to get a PhD or an MD. And they met and they just kind of like escaped together. And that's how I always think of it. Like, they're moving to America. So they get to America, and my mom, I think, has like this crisis because she never really like, you know, got help after this tragedy. She just like in trying to figure out how to assimilate all of these magical things that, you know, magical thinking was a big part of her psychological framework after her parents' loss.
Magical thinking meaning?
Meaning assigning, you know, I think my grandmother's dying words to her were to take care of her younger brother and sister, and she was nine. So I think, you know, she was just, had created this life, this fantasy life about who her mother was and like what her life meant. And I'm sure there was so much survivor guilt that I can't even begin to fathom. So the duality of her like wanting to have a better life, wanting to have a family but not wanting to have a family, not really understanding what motherhood is, and then the guilt of doing better than her siblings, and she was the only one who got educated in her family, coming to America and cutting her hair and not wearing a sari, and like all of these things were huge decisions for her that had all of these really big meanings, you know. So they got assigned big magical significances that may or may not have been like actually real, but they were very real to her. So they were here for 5 years and ended up in Pittsburgh, and she kind of decided that they should go back because she should be suffering along with the rest of her family. And then she got pregnant with me, and they had already had, you know, my sister was 7 years older than I was. So they'd already kind of not renewed their visa. So we moved back, and the whole time, you know, I think my mom and my dad regretted that decision. And so every, you know, the whole time I was growing up, I was hearing, we're going back to America. When we move back to America, when we go back to America. So this like luminous goal of the U.S. was always in my brain. So I never really sank into being Indian because I was always aware that we had a couple of things that were imported. I knew all the words to all the Beatles songs, and my classmates didn't, you know. That's not like what drove them, but I always had this fantasy life of what the future was. But food was this anchor in our family. My dad's mom lived with us, and she hadn't been raised to be a good cook. I mean, she was, you know, married off when she was 14. But my mother, for some reason, had internalized all of these recipes and this cooking technique. Like, she was like me as a little child in Pakistan, knew how to cook. Like, she always hung out with the women in the center of town who were at the granary and the tandoor, and she just knew how to cook. She had this love for food, and she just like literally passed it on to me. So I would always be in the kitchen with them and eating the scrapings off the bottom of the milk pot and looking, you know, like the pickles and like all of it. And when we came to America, it was a huge disappointment to move to the Bronx because those were not the pictures that I was looking at of you know, in the Sears catalogs or whatever my mom had at that point. And it was a very traumatic time for us. I mean, you know, I think anytime anybody moves to a different country, there's so many challenges. And as a kid, you don't really, you're kind of isolated and your parents are terrified. And it's a really disconcerting thing to see your parents terrified. And my mom kind of like was paralyzed with fear and depression and conflict and guilt and, you know, so the dinner table, but one thing that we didn't compromise on, or what she didn't compromise on, was how we ate. And the fact that she did make sure that we ate a home cooked meal every single day. And that was the one 30 minute part of our day that was normal and happy and sustaining, and I felt taken care of. And
do you feel like food played that role for her, that if she was depressed and fearful, but here's something she could control?
Yes.
And it was based on nostalgia, right? I mean, it's not like she was adapting to whatever she was finding in the markets. I mean, she was cooking from home.
Right.
But you were still eating essentially Indian food.
Yes.
In the Bronx.
For sure. And it's, you know, it's amazing to me how much she just was able to channel where she came from. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't anything, you know, India doesn't have this like culture of acknowledgement of tragedy. It is just like, you don't think about the bad things, you know, you just don't talk about it. Nobody in her family, in her extended family, acknowledged what happened to her. There was never any, or what happened to her and her brother and sister, and like nobody took care of that, you know? So like, I know that making those kidney beans and making that sag was a way of her speaking to her mother and remembering her childhood. And
that seems so powerful, because you can imagine like being in the kitchen so contemplative, and it gives you time and space when exactly. The rest of time and space is probably busy doing caretaking, yes. Things that are more practical. And to just think like, where did this come from? And like, just the memory, it's so fluid. And
even if it's not
conscious,
you're not thinking about it consciously, somewhere in your mind, when you cut that ginger within your hand, you smell it. And the garam masala recipe is, you know, not something she just made up. It's like, she didn't know the specs,
right.
But she knew the smell. And she replicated that smell. And it's funny, my dad and my brother are in India right now, and they went all the way up to Amritsar on the Pakistani border. And my brother, you know, WhatsApped me, and he said, it's amazing that all the food here tastes like hers. The closer I get to Pakistan, the more it tastes like her food. And I just, yeah, it's pretty stunning.
It's so powerful also because it's all from memory.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as though she said, I'm going to replicate this. It's not like there were the recipes.
There were no recipes.
And that's such a gift.
It is. Yeah.
And I've heard you say that you've, you know, absorbed that love of food, but also understanding the food so deeply, you're able to riff on it.
Right.
And it's interesting that in her case, she wasn't really riffing.
Well, she did end up riffing, because then she had kids and we were in America, and we were like, we want spaghetti. Like, you know, we want meatloaf. And so she would make quinoa meatloaf, you know?
Right.
And spaghetti kind of always had some cumin or something in it, so it ended up tasting like skyline chili, which I realized later on, oh, yeah, this is the same. So she was a great riffer, and we would go to restaurants, and she'd always have some critique, you know, like the greens are dirty, or like, you know, I can make this better at home, or like, you know. And to me, as a bratty little kid who wanted more than we had, you know, it's like, oh, you just don't want to spend the money on going to a restaurant, like I'm never eating out with you again, you know.
Did she take that criticism into the rest of your family life, or was it sort of reserved for food and restaurants?
Oh, no, it was everything. I got a 98. Oh, what happened?
That's so frustrating.
Oh, God,
like,
yeah.
Just like, if they could only understand.
I know. Like, could I just get a good job one time?
Right. I was thinking about that with my own mother, and I realized there's this intersection of her feeling of being valued or being valuable is saying, this is how you could have done it better, rather than the value of the mother being, great job. She's like, what good is that? Like,
right, exactly.
Great job. You don't get better.
Everything's a teaching moment, right? Right, exactly. Like, and if you're not teaching, then you're failing at, right. at motherhood.
Yeah. She also has in my mother's case, she has these very funny moments. Like, she, you know, always is making fun of herself. Like, she's looking for her glasses and they're on top of her head. You know, that right. type of. So she's like, another teaching moment for me. So you're... love of food comes so clearly from the way they grew up. I was curious if where the love of music began.
It was kind of simultaneous as far as I can remember. I think of the day, like there's a couple of days that I remember my dad would like play hooky, which was never ever happened except for like these 2 days. And I remember he made like these really buttery thin omelets. And I was listening to Yesterday and Today by the Beatles. And it was like, that day is just embranded in my soul, you know?
That so, is you.
Yeah,
I mean, that
exactly.
just, like, it was that moment. Exactly. That's incredible. That was you like, even remember that.
I mean, I was looking at the cover of them sitting on the speaker, and I was looking at the speaker, and I was eating this buttery omelet, and my dad was home, and like, you know, it was like, oh, these guys with this amazing hair, like, who, you know, who are these white dudes? They're so cute. You know? I mean, I didn't know anything about, like, what year it was. Like, when did the record come out? It just had this, like, magical sound. So those sounds and, like, my dad had this reel-to-reel player that he somehow brought. Like, I need to ask him what kind of trunk they shipped over.
You hear all the stories about the spices, but very rarely a reel-to-reel.
Yeah, exactly.
And heavier.
He had a mixtape, but it was like this big, you know?
Wow.
So he had all of these songs, and I would like really wait, and I learned how to thread it really early on. So I would wait until everybody was like not in the room, and you know, our house wasn't big, but like in my mind I was like alone in the room, and I would just like turn it up as far as it could go. And like I remember my sister somehow scored a Deep Purple record, and I was just like, the recorded sounds were just like, I think, you know, so much of it is fantasy, and it just gave me a feeling of like possibilities and freedom. And I have the age now to look back and try to identify what that feeling was, but it was just, you know, things from another place have always been a big draw.
I wonder, because, you know, your mother lived in that fantasy in a way, mm-hmm. all the magical thinking, and yet your parents wanted you to be so practical.
Yes.
I wonder what type of conflict they had inside themselves. You know, my daughter's in love with music and food. What is this?
Well, you know, they never thought that I would parlay those into any sort of practical things, you know, and maybe I didn't. Practicality, anyway, I'm not sure. I think they, you know, in our culture, the things that you're passionate about are not necessarily the things that you turn into your career. You have a few options. You can be a doctor or a lawyer, and then I guess perhaps an engineer, but you're a girl. And then that's about it. Maybe a pharmacist if you didn't get into medical school. Oh, betak, yeah. You know, like,
how did you toss off all the expectations that were played, actually the reverse, but the box that you were put in as a girl?
Well, my mom actually was really forward-thinking in that way, and I think that she realized, as being a girl who was all alone, had no support, nobody to tell her what her period was, or, you know, she probably had, like, resolved this conflict of education. Like, is it appropriate for me to be even educated? And I think she realized that that was her only option. And she just focused on that, and that was the thing that she could control. If she could persevere, she could work hard, and she could overcome anything. And she was in a boarding school filled with other girls. So, you know, there was some kind of, like, fortune in that. And I think she realized there were some innate things that she could just see that were unjust. Like, why do women have to bear this burden? Why is it so much harder for me to want to, you know, become a doctor? Or, you know, what's the big deal? So she raised my sister and I with a lot of baggage, but the one thing that wasn't there is like, you can be what you want to be. But she didn't really realize what that meant to me as an American girl, you know, that those, anything you want to be is a huge, vast array of choices. I think she meant you can be a doctor if you want to.
You took it a lot farther. So you went to college in Amherst.
I did.
My daughter actually is in college at Amherst as well. And that's where the music career began, right? Because you were at in air quotes, because you were working at a radio station.
Yeah, just working at the college station. And there was something that happened in high school. Like, I just really just fell in love with music, and like reel-to-reels have always played a kind of an important role. I had one. I had a little quarter-inch thing, and I would record myself singing, and I never was like a big singer, but I would sing along to the songs. I had like I figured out how to wire this makeshift karaoke situation, so I could like sing on top of U2 songs or Duran Duran songs. I remember I asked my mom. And my dad, like, had already gotten a job in Florida, and they were going to move, like, when I graduated, if I could take a year off and just, like, learn how to play music. And she was like, what are you talking about? No, you're going to college, and you're staying on this track. And so I begrudgingly went to school, and I didn't know what a major, like, you have to declare a major. I don't know what I want to do. So psychology became this thing that, you know, was, like, a compromise, because my parents thought I was a really good person to talk to, because they would always talk to me about their problems.
They needed that.
Yeah, they needed me.
Too bad that as a kid, but right. As a kid, but.
So I just declared psychology, even though I really kind of wanted to go into film, and I really loved to read, and so comparative literature, and I was taking a lot of like history of Western thought and all of these classes. But then the radio station was there, and I worked at, like, it happened to be in my dorm. The first one was a pirate station, and so I had this like late night show, and yeah, it just kind of grew. I ended up working at the bigger one and did the production studio time there and learned how to, like, you know, make carts and, like, splice tape. And
you seem to have an unbelievable facility with electronics. Fixing things, cords.
I used to. I'm really rusty now, but I love recording. I love the studio, and I love the whole process of taking an idea and then just getting weird with it.
And so you ended up like meeting a band that also played in Raleigh.
Right. I was working at the station. I ended up becoming like a promotions director person, and I was working with a concert board on campus, and UMass just happens to have this really great program if you want to do it. And so there would be a big show in the quad every year. And so we were booking all these bands. So I was meeting bands because I was their promotions person. So they would get there and I would be like in charge of their hospitality, which, you know, looking back, like, prepared me to have a music venue.
Wow, there you were.
I know, right? So, you know, like Robin Hitchcock and like all these people are coming through, and I ended up just befriending some people from Raleigh. And, we were kind of like really into REM and like all these Southern bands were having their renaissance. So me and my friend just like drove down to Raleigh, and that again just felt like a little magical place that had all of this potential. And I think we kind of matched up in where we were in our growth in a weird poetic way.
So no fear of like, I have no idea what I'm doing, I'm just getting in a car.
The fearful part was having to move back to New York or to get a job at a record company, and not like really feeling like that was really what I wanted. You know, am I going to be a marketing person? And, you know, I didn't realize that some of the people that I was like interacting with at these labels that I thought were super important, they were actually really douchey. And I didn't want to turn into that. And I didn't want to like figure it out with having, you know, New York rent. And I did not like Boston, like, not, no offense. I mean, it's a wonderful place, but I couldn't see myself living there. But there was something that allured me about the South, and my parents thought I was crazy. They thought I was going to get like racially attacked, and you know, they had all this fear about like, what is the South?
Have you found that?
I have not. You know, I felt like my high school in the Bronx was way more segregated than, I mean, I'm not saying that there's not an issue, but it, I mean, not, I haven't had any, like, racially motivated experiences. I got called a lot more epithets in New York than I ever did. Yeah.
It's a good view of the South because, of course,
yes,
you know, the reputation can be fierce and not positive.
Definitely true. And a lot of it is warranted, you know.
So you you met your husband, with whom you have the restaurants and the bands. You have this incredible, very intertwined life. But I love that you, when you met, he was your intern.
Yeah.
Tell me.
He probably doesn't like to talk about it. Maybe he does. I mean, we've always had this duality in our relationship. And I think I function in dualities all the time anyway. Immigrant, American, you know, music and food. And then he and I... we were just really good friends for a couple of years. And, you know, I was kind of working my way out of working in the company that he was interning. I just thought, like, I can do this. You know, I kind of relate to the bands better than my boss does. And I'm just going to do this. And so I had friends that were at this point in their musical career that they were just starting new bands at the time that I was trying to itching to like get out. And I wasn't making a living really. I had to wait tables to like supplement. Anyway, I, you know, had declared that I was going to start my own business to my parents. So I kind of had to do it. And, we just started working on this thing together, and like he kind of gave me the encouragement and the guts to like play.
I was going to ask, so many of the choices that you've made in your life, looking back on them from this conversation sitting here as we are in Charleston, you know, it feels like they are imbued with a tremendous amount of confidence and self-knowledge. And those things are hard to get. In looking back, do you feel like you had confidence? Like, what is the thing that allowed you to, you know, make, like, say to your parents, I'm starting a business, and you're like, well, I don't really know exactly what that means or what it's going to be. Like, what was that?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I had any confidence, and I don't think that I had any self-knowledge, really. But I would just blurt these things out, and I don't know where they came from. And then it was like, oh, okay. I didn't know, like, when I said I'm going to open a restaurant, I didn't know what that meant. Like, Jesus, if I had, I probably would never have done it. And, you know, I decided that I was going to open my own business. But I think, you know, looking back, I think I was just too scared to write a resume. And I was too, like, just disgusted by the whole process. I think I didn't have the confidence to go find a job. So I just decided to open a business. You know, I'm so terrified all the time that I end up making really scary choices because they seem easier in the moment. So no, it's not because of self-confidence. It's more about like being able to do it on my own terms, and if it fails, then it's just my own personal little failure. Now I know that that's not really what it's there's more to it than that, but they all seem very accidental at the time.
That's extraordinary. With that thought, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about food and music, how they relate, and the extraordinary business that she indeed has built. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Brooklyn Ball Factory uses the best ingredients to make Japanese comfort food, like their bento boxes featuring meatballs, grilled veggies, Japanese fried chicken, or pork shabu shabu. Plus, visit Brooklyn Ball Factory's sister restaurants, Momo Sushi Shack, Samurai Papa, Samurai Mama, Bozu, and Kitade Shokudo. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Speaking Broadly. This is Dana Cowan, and my guest today is Chidi Kumar, who's an extraordinary musician and chef. And a bunch of this seems to have happened somewhat accidentally, but fortuitously.
Right, yeah.
So you now have in Raleigh, I haven't been, I can't wait to go, but a building that houses three businesses in one that right. you run. You started with a partner, but now it's you and your husband who are running it. And so you have a music venue, you have a downstairs bar, and you have a restaurant, Garland.
That's correct.
Okay, good. Just check all that off. And you've united these two loves that you have that we talked about earlier in the show, which is music and food. What do you think the commonalities are of music and food?
Well, we've been talking so much about memory, and I think that, you know, those two senses, our sense of taste and our ability to, like, remember songs and just music in general are so linked to, they have transportive powers. So I think, without getting too analytical, you know, people have songs that can just put them right back into, like, you know, their first kiss, or, like, you know, the car ride to school with their mom, or, you know, moments, monumental moments are, it's the same as, like, you know, that bite of chicken soup can put you in your grandmother's lap again. You know, I think it's those two things are interesting, that music and food are the only thing. It's not like, you know, you don't look at a painting and all of a sudden you might remember,
right?
But it's very, like, that's cognitive. It's not heart. And I think music and food are, like, very, they have a heart connection. And we were talking about this last night, like, a woman here was saying that she just started, like, taking drum lessons. And after she sold her restaurant, I just thought, yes, that's so awesome. And as somebody who's, like, supposedly a musician, like, I haven't picked, you know, my band hasn't practiced in 5 months. And I am dying inside because, you know, I said, like, it's so important for us to have the things that you lose track of time. And, like, you know, you were talking about my mom, like, the losing yourself in doing something. And I think, you know, I guess painting probably is the same, but, like, making that connection between what's in your head and what comes out of your hands, those two activities kind of have that same relationship. And you can take an idea and then just, like, you kind of become a vehicle for that creation, and you're helping it along, but almost sometimes it seems predetermined and you just kind of don't want to stand in the carrot's way or that song's way, you know?
That actually sounds a lot like how you've lived your entire life, right? The things come out of you and it turns out that's what I'm going to do.
Right.
You know, and
right.
The food comes out and the music comes out, and they're all just very, you're just very in touch with the creative part of you that allows you to move forward in each of these ways.
I guess so. I never thought of myself that way, but, you know, I guess I was raised to be, like, a fatalist. You know, my kismet is such a huge part of India, and, like, I guess I just have bad kismet, or, like, my kismet is good. So predetermination is a thing that I really, like, I remember struggling with when I was taking those history classes and learning about existentialism, like, wait, how do I reconcile those two concepts? And, like, you actually have a choice, you know, which one you want to believe in. So, yeah, predetermination is an interesting thing.
I think it's really frustrating to believe that everything is predetermined. I don't know how those predetermined people don't just sit on a lawn chair and drink beer.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, that's how you keep the people down. Like, you just, you know, you say this is the lot you were dealt. Just live with it.
That's not happening here. So, with the food that you're creating now, even in the restaurant, because you're a home cook, and so it's not like you went to the Culinary Institute or something like that. How did you figure out how to scale up your food, how to make food for a restaurant?
Well, I had been in my culture, we always cook for 30. You know, anyway, so, like, I always had dinner parties. Like, even when I was in a dorm, like, I would make chicken curry because I was dying for my mom's chicken curry. And, you know, if I'm making it for my, I'm not going to make it for myself. So I'd invite everybody on my floor to come down to the basement and eat. And when I moved to Raleigh, I would have these dinner parties. And like, you know, I had friends who were working at Magnolia Grill and like working at these really great restaurants. And they'd see my knife and I learned how to cut like onions in my hand, like not use a cutting board. And they're all like, you just cook for all these people with this knife? But that was just something that kind of came naturally to me. I was catering a little bit and I like math. But it took a while to like realize that I had to write the recipes down. And that was the most terrifying part of it. Like I can't cook everything. I can't do that every day. And it quickly dawned on me like, I need to learn how to standardize this stuff and teach people. Like, it didn't occur to me that that was something that I would have to do. And now that's like the biggest part of my job is to like be able to translate a recipe, and that time span becomes shorter and shorter. Now it's a part of the creative process. I'm writing all the time. So, but you know, terror teaches you like, you got to do this. Like, you can't, you just sold all of this out. How many days can you make this in a row? You have to figure out how to like balance keeping things fresh, but also keeping it like economically sustainable and sustainable for your own body and like keeping your business open. I just have sustainability on my head because we just finished talking about this panel, but yeah, you have to, you don't have much time to figure that out. You got to do that like quick.
And what did you learn about running a business from, you know, the jump start that you had, like you started it,
mm-hmm.
but you probably hadn't done a business plan before.
No. Yeah, I learned everything that I know now, which is probably 8% of what I should know, by just doing it. And a lot of it is instinct. And, you know, this is a conversation that's happening a lot. Like, I had so much shame about opening a restaurant without the training. I didn't want to be called a chef. And then I had this whole conflict about like, will my staff treat me like a chef if I'm not a chef? And when do I get to be the chef? And these were all like self-imposed limitations, but I really wanted to earn it, you know? And I'm not sure if that happened or not, but you know, at some point you do have a moment where like, oh, that chief, okay, that's what that means, and that's not an ego thing. Really, it shouldn't be. It should be about the responsibility that you do have to keep your staff motivated and interested and keep your business open so that they can have a paycheck and so they can support their family and that they can grow because they're in your kitchen, hopefully not for just a paycheck, because it's not a big paycheck. Hopefully it's something that like they're inspired by too, and to fuel their passion is your job. So that's like the biggest lesson, is to like all of the things that you don't think are important, those details, those little minute decisions that you make every day as a business owner, it's important to share your intention and like why you made that choice, because guess what, they might have a better idea. So I think, you know, vocalizing stuff and like communicating, it didn't occur to me how important that was going to be.
And what did you do to deal with the shame?
I worked my ass off. I just worked. I worked through it. And I still got here last night and I was like in this room with all of these amazing women. I'm like, what am I doing here? You know, I don't belong on this panel. But this is what life
dealt
me.
But you do.
Well, I don't know, but you know, you just try to earn it.
And music plays an important role in the restaurant and then of course in the two venues, but what role does music play when you're thinking about food? Because I think about that moment you described with your father where the two came together so perfectly. And when you're thinking about feeding people in your restaurant, what are you thinking about the soundtrack?
You know, it's funny, like lately, because I'm not so immersed in music anymore, and this is going to sound really psychotic, but lyrics will get into my head, and sometimes I feel like those are messages. I really probably should be on medication.
So far it sounds so good.
I think in songs a lot, like not necessarily in a creative way, but just like the things that are, I'm really like sensitive to And you can ask my friends and my staff, like, if a song I hate comes on, I can't stand it. Like, turn the Spin Doctors off right now. You know, I can't deal with it. Sorry, Spin Doctors fans. I like weird music, and I like music that takes a chance. Or if it's catchy and poppy, I like that, how deliberate it is. Either way, I think being deliberate is the common thing that I really love about music and food. And it's not, and I don't like music that's like overproduced and created to be a product to sell. So commerce really needs to not be this obvious part of it. So the beauty of the idea and like the honesty in that reflection of that idea, I think, is what inspires me in both ways. So like things that are recorded really carefully, or really weirdly on purpose. Like, why does David Bowie put psst on that in that song over and over again? Because he could. So yeah.
But if you put yourself in the seat of the diner, do you think that they're hearing the music? Like, are you thinking about how they hear while they eat?
I do a lot. I mean, the sound of our restaurant is a very pervasive issue, because we have a music venue upstairs, and then the club downstairs just start bumping at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. And what do we play? You know, does the music then compete with sound check? You know, we have high ceilings. How reflective is it? Like, can we spend the $6,000 that we really should? Like, when is a good time to do that? Because as soon as you commit to it, your ice machine and your HVAC will break. And then that's really important. You know, you can't, you can't.
That's really the restaurateur's life.
Yeah. Right, right. So, I mean, those choices. But we, you know, I think like, and I also have this curse. Like, I walk out of the kitchen and I ask anybody on my staff, as soon as I walk out, it'll be between songs. And I'm like, you guys, there's no music playing. What are you doing? They're like, it's just between songs. We chill. Like, just relax. But yeah, I mean, you know, I got on somebody because he was listening to like some modern Chicago blues. And I was like, we're not a barbecue restaurant, dude. Like, put on something appropriate. I don't want to hear like super mainstream classic rock. It doesn't, it's kind of like the aesthetics, the physical aesthetics of a restaurant should match. And the way the staff dresses should match, the music should also match.
And I want to go back to what you said about not having picked up an instrument and not having practiced. That must feel like half of you is missing.
It does. I'm literally like aching. But I'm also marinating. I'm actively thinking about this. And I am trying to not like... Like, I will go home and play guitar at night and just, you know, even for 10 minutes, just to see if I can still play. And it comes back and it's like, oh, thank God. Okay, I can still kind of, maybe, I don't know if I can do this on stage right now. I hope I can, because we have a show coming up in September. but I'm also thinking, I wonder if this is a good time to, like, learn something new, figure out a different recording technique or a different way of songwriting, or learn MIDI. Like, you know, maybe I can work with synths or something. I don't know. I mean, it is, you know, life presents this challenge. So maybe I'll take this as an opportunity to be like a beginner at something else.
I love that idea. I was just assuming that you didn't play because you just don't have time. But do you feel like you could make the time for something else or to begin something new?
You know, something always has to give. Time is not an infinite. I would have to give something up. And, you know, when we do have shows and we have a deadline, because the show is a deadline, we find the time to practice on Monday nights. But then I don't get my rest. Then I don't cook. So then I'm eating takeout. So something, you know, there's always a compromise.
And when you look ahead, you know, I guess because things just come out of you. Like, if I said, in 5 years, like, what's the thing that you'd blurt that could be the truth in 5 years?
In 5 years, I would like to have more time to be still. I'd like to do other things that are creative. I'm not saying that would be instead of the restaurant. But I think in the next couple of years, I have to figure out how to incorporate more things that make me happy, which includes traveling and playing music. I mean, those are things that I can't permanently eradicate from my life.
And your favorite dish to cook in the restaurant? Like, as you develop the menu, I'm sure there's a million things you love, but what stands out as the thing that you feel is like most describes your heart and why?
I don't know if it's a dish, but I think making a tarka,
what is that? A chonk,
I guess, or like getting a oil really hot and throwing the seeds into it, and now I'm in love with curry leaves. Like, that process to finish a dish is, it connects my entire life together on a very literal way, because that was the first hot oil thing that my mother let me do. I would always boil the lentils, but she never let me finish it until like grasshopper was ready. But to me, it's also like, I love the idea of being able to just finish it in the last second and take something that was really bland, and that one little thing that you can do to give it that pop, and you can save it. You know, I love the idea of like that. It's almost like a, what do you call it? It's like a medic, you know, somebody that just can come in and save your life at the very end. I just love that idea. It gives me hope that I can fuck everything up and then still fix it in the last minute. Sorry, I used the F-bomb. Is that okay?
F-bomb's okay in Heritage Radio Network. At the end of my show, I have two questions. One, what can you teach me in words that ideally you'd actually teach me, you know, doing the thing?
Well, how to talk into a mic.
Great.
So most people think a mic should be straight on, but there's so many different kinds of microphones. So most radio mics are RE20s, which are, it's interesting, they use the same microphone for a kick drum as you do for a recording radio. Like, all talk radio hosts have that same big mic. And you don't talk into it like this, you talk into it sideways. Not straight on, so it's like a 45 degree angle. And that gets, so the RE20 has this like ability to have really low range and a very full range of sound. So you don't want your voice to sound like this, like mine normally sounds anyway. So to get your throat, you don't want to approach it head on.
I love that. Thank you. That's useful for me. Folding the pants is also useful, but
everybody needs to know how to fold pants.
Approaching a mic right is great. And the last, I love to have the women pay it forward, give a shout out to another woman in the industry who they feel hasn't had enough attention. So who would that person be for you and why?
I am inspired by the other women in our downtown community who own restaurants. So Angela Salamanca and Caroline Morrison come to mind.
What's the restaurant?
So Angela has Centro. Angela's a Colombian immigrant who has a Mexican restaurant called Centro, and then a three-year-old Miss Caloria called Gallo Pelon. And I think that what she has done with Gallo especially is so beautiful and really deliberate. And the space is lovely. Sourcing interesting alcohol in North Carolina is a very big challenge, and she's done it remarkably well, and she makes it look super easy. And Caroline has a vegetarian restaurant, and they're extremely busy. And she and her wife have like a very successful business, making very increasingly creative and interesting vegetarian vegan food that is like allergy conscious. And she's just like a great inspiration, the way that they thoughtfully run their business with a lot of conscience, both of them, is very inspiring.
That's great. Thank you so much, Chi, for joining me today on Speaking Broadly. I really appreciate your time in the middle of the chaos of this fabulous fab conference. Shout out to Randy Weinstein, who is the creator of the Fab Conference. It's a wonderful place where women get together to be inspired and to learn from each other and to hold each other up. So thank you, all your listeners, for joining us this week. If people want to find you, Chi, where do they find you? On social.
At Chidi Koo, at Garland Raleigh, on all of the things. I'm not on Facebook, and I never have been.
And you know where to find me, at Speaking Broadly. And come on back next week. That's where you can find me again. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.